You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma-Louise Fenelon.
2018 was a significant year for the law of inquests, with important judgments handed down on the burden of proof in suicide, on scope in relation to the Birmingham pub bombings, and on causation in relation to medical negligence. Here with me to provide a whistle-stop tour of the most significant developments from 2018 is Jeremy Heim QC, also from 1 Crown Office Row. Jeremy, welcome.
Hello.
Jeremy has extensive experience in inquest law, and in a much publicised inquest this year, represented the family of Natasha Ednan Lamparous, who tragically died after eating a pret-a-manger baguette before boarding a BA flight to France. To begin, we'll start with the cab rank policy. Those practising inquest law will be familiar with the controversy surrounding the decision concerning the Adath Yisrael Burial Society and Her Majesty's Senior Coroner for Inner North London, in which the Divisional Court ruled that the Senior Coroner had acted unlawfully in adopting a policy that resulted in Jewish and Muslim families facing delays in the burials of family members contrary to their religious beliefs. The policy at the heart of this decision is to the effect that no death will be prioritised in any way over any other because of the religion of the deceased or family, either by the coroner's officers or coroners. The result of this policy was a blanket ban on expedition in circumstances where a religion stipulates that a burial must take place within a short period of death, for example, in circumstances where the family is waiting for the coroner to decide whether a post-mortem examination is required. Jeremy, can you tell us a little about how the court addressed the argument that a so-called cab rank rule in relation to the bereaved ensured fairness, regardless of religious beliefs?
Well, I think the coroner's policy suffered from a fundamental flaw, which was that it failed to strike any proper balance between the rights of those concerned, that is to say, those waiting for a burial, those with particular religious beliefs who might want their loved one to be buried in accordance with their religion, which in the case of Islam and Judaism requires a very speedy burial. And what the policy had done by way of a rigid policy is it required the coroner and her officers to leave out of account altogether those requirements, that is to say, those Jewish and Muslim ritual or religious requirements. And that was completely wrong because it, in fact, discriminated on that ground.
One of the interesting aspects of this particular case was that the senior coroner appeared to initially have the support of the chief coroner going into the case. Can you speak a little bit about that and how that issue was resolved?
As I understand it, the argument which the chief coroner was supporting was the argument that to allow queue jumping for one particular denomination of religious belief would be unfair and that all persons ought to be treated the same. But in fact, that argument on proper analysis, in fact, discriminated against those who required special expedition for the burial of their loved one.
And obviously, following the decision, the Chief Coroner, His Honour Judge Mark Lucruft QC, issued guidance number 28 on decision-making and expedited decisions, which practitioners will want to become familiar with. No review of 2018 would be complete without examining the significance of the case concerning Maughan and Her Majesty's Senior Coroner for Oxfordshire, a case which examined and restated the burden of proof that now applies in order for a coroner or jury to return a verdict of suicide. The case concerned an individual who was detained and appeared to have made a ligature with which he hanged himself. The coroner seems to have accepted that there was no basis upon which the jury could have been satisfied to the criminal standard that the deceased intended to kill himself, but he nonetheless left the jury to consider questions directed at this issue, but on the balance of probabilities. The jury duly returned narrative conclusions to the effect that they were satisfied that he deliberately tied the ligature around his neck and probably intended to kill himself. Jeremy, can you tell us a little about what the court found?
Well, I think on the first issue, the question was whether or not the inconsistency, essentially, between the conclusion on the balance of probabilities and what was required for a short-form verdict of suicide, which the coroner was not prepared to leave to the jury, was inconsistent, and whether, in fact, that was unlawful. And the way that it was dealt with by the divisional court was to look at it as a matter of logic, saying that if the standard of proof required to determine that the deceased committed suicide is the criminal standard, and the necessary facts have been proved only on the balance of probabilities, this does not mean that a conclusion which records those facts is not one of suicide. It means that the coroner or jury cannot lawfully reach that conclusion. And so essentially the first conclusion issue was it would be unlawful. But then they went on to say, and in particular Lord Justice Leggett, one of the first lessons in logic, however, is that accepting the validity of an argument always leaves open two possibilities. One is to accept the conclusion, but the other is to reject the premise. And essentially on the second issue, they went to hold that the standard of proof required for proving suicide is not the criminal standard, but the balance of probabilities, by reference to, amongst others, the cases such as Braganza and BP Shipping, a civil standard of proof applied, and pointing out, importantly, that the coronial jurisdiction has become detached from the criminal jurisdiction and no longer forms the basis of essentially forming the basis of an indictment for criminal proceedings. And therefore, there is no close connection anymore between criminal law and the coronial jurisdiction. In those circumstances, there was no justification for a standard of proof beyond reasonable doubt.
In cases involving deaths in prison, for example, it's often the case that jurors find it difficult to determine the question of intent, which is a tricky one. For example, in prison, the argument is understandably made that the individual attempting suicide expects to be discovered by a prison guard or a medical professional. This presumably means that suicide is often underreported, and I wonder, do you think as a result of this judgment, suicide figures may now become more accurate?
They may do. I think one has to remember that in many cases, whether one's using the criminal standard of proof, satisfied so that you're sure, or the balance of probabilities, the coroner will want there to be evidence of intention to take one's own life. Absent that intention, whether balance of probabilities or criminal standard, you're not going to end up with that verdict. But I think that the high standard, the high criminal standard, has resulted in underreporting historically. There's often been a good reason for it. And an interesting facet of this particular case is that the claimant's family were Roman Catholics, and they particularly wanted to avoid a finding of suicide because of the religious stigma which attaches to it. And a balance of probabilities finding of suicide may, in their view, affect how the death is viewed, not just by themselves, but by the church to which they are affiliated.
In relation to scope, there was a very interesting decision from the Court of Appeal regarding the inquests into the 1974 Birmingham pub bombings. A number of members of chambers are currently acting for the coroner in that inquest. On the evening of the 21st of November 1974, bombs exploded in two Birmingham city centre pubs. The bombings, which are thought to have been perpetrated by the IRA, caused the death of 21 people and injured a further 220. The criminal investigation into the bombing led to the conviction of six men. These men, known as the Birmingham Six, served nearly 17 years in prison before the Court of Appeal quashed their convictions in 1991. Since then, no one has been brought to trial or arrested in relation to this matter, despite the bombings being the subject of an extensive criminal investigation. In 2016, it was announced that the inquest would be reopened. The former chief coroner, Sir Peter Thornton QC, was appointed to conduct these inquests. In July 2017, he ruled that the enhanced Article 2 duty did not require an inquiry into the identity of the perpetrators of the bombings. The coroner's ruling caused significant upset to the families of the bombing victims, who argued that if the perpetrator issue was not explored, it would be impossible properly to determine how the deceased came by their deaths. The families brought judicial review proceedings, seeking an order quashing the coroner's decision, an order compelling him to include this issue within the scope of the inquests, and a declaration that the decision was contrary to Article 2 of the ECHR. Initially, the High Court ruled that the coroner's decision was not contrary to Article 2 and refused to grant the mandatory order sought. However, the court did quash the coroner's decision. The Court of Appeal was subsequently asked to consider scope.
I think fundamentally what the Court of Appeal determined in respect of scope is firstly that scope is a matter of discretion for the coroner, that there is a false dichotomy identified by the divisional court decision between judgment and discretion, and on judicial review what one is looking at is whether the coroner has exceeded the wide discretion that is open to him or her when deciding on scope. But fundamentally, they refocused the inquiry onto what the purpose of an inquest is, and having identified that purpose, the extent to which the evidence in relation to identifying perpetrators was necessary for the discharge of the functions of the inquest. They restated that the purpose of the inquest is to ascertain the answers or to elicit the answers to four questions: who the deceased was and how, when and where he or she came about his or her death, and in an Article 2 inquest, that how question becomes in what circumstances. They recited, and there is a linkage here between the case of Hambleton, this case, and the case of Morm, the fact that for centuries, both before and long after there was an established police force, it was a function of an inquest to investigate homicides and to commit for trial those the jury concluded were responsible. But that jurisdiction was abolished by Section 56 of the Criminal Law Act. Essentially, an inquest no longer performs any criminal or ancillary criminal purpose. And in short, it's simply not the function of the inquest to answer the question who the perpetrators were. The only purpose or statutory purpose of the inquest is to answer the four statutory questions.
I thought it interesting in this judgment was the fact that the court stated that whether the perpetrator issue must be investigated at an inquest is not a black and white question to which the answer is universally the same in every inquest. And in this particular inquest, the coroner's decision was taken against the background of a comprehensive police investigation that was unable satisfactorily to identify the perpetrators and the existence of a recent report into the issue. So in those circumstances, the coroner was correct to take the decision that he had taken. Presumably this means that in other inquests, the question of perpetrator may remain a live issue.
It certainly may do. I mean, I think the court were very keen to point out that there will be many inquests where the identity of the person or persons responsible for a death are known and won't in fact be in any doubt. And indeed, they may even be interested persons in the inquest. And the fact is that most cases where state responsibility is alleged will fall into that category. And the issue will be whether lethal force was used by a state agent or not. It isn't a black and white issue. There may be cases where the identity of the individual or the perpetrator is relevant, but one must not forget the prohibition in statute in Section 10(2) applying to the conclusion of a coroner's inquest, namely the impropriety of naming the individual as part of the conclusion. That's not to say that the full scope of the inquest may not encompass as evidence facts which point towards a particular individual or individuals being culpable for an unlawful killing.
In a case concerning medical negligence in the context of inquests, Parkinson and Her Majesty's senior coroner for Kent dealt with the issue of system failure and slammed the door on any hopes that this avenue remained open following the Grand Chamber decision in Lopez de Souza Fernandez and Portugal. Jeremy, can you tell us a little bit initially about the background to Lopez de Souza Fernandez?
There was an initial decision of the fourth section of the European Court of Human Rights on Lopez de Souza, which seemed to suggest that in cases which would, in domestic parlance, be called cases of mere negligence, could amount to a breach of human rights. And that case went to the Grand Chamber in Strasbourg, and that very much poured cold water on that idea and restated the law as it had been in Powell, essentially to the effect that absent something more than mere negligence and essentially systemic failure, there would be no basis for the engagement of Article 2. Indeed, one might say the Grand Chamber went further than Powell in limiting the circumstances where systemic failure was likely to engage Article 2 to those circumstances where there had been effectively a complete denial of access to medical treatment by reasons of a deficiency in the system as a whole.
And obviously this case came up again more recently in relation to Parkinson. Parkinson concerned a 91-year-old woman who was taken to A&E in January 2011. She was assessed by a doctor who formed the view that she was dying and there was no useful treatment that could be given to her, and that as she was in the last moments of life, doing anything would not have been beneficial. Her son became aggressive and attempted to perform mouth-to-mouth resuscitation despite being advised against this by A&E staff, and Mrs. Parkinson deteriorated rapidly and died shortly afterwards. At the inquest, the coroner determined that Article 2 did not apply and rejected the submission that he ought to enter a verdict of gross negligence manslaughter. He ultimately found that Mrs. Parkinson died of natural causes and that any additional treatment that could have been provided to her would have been ineffective. Further, he refused to make a prevention of future deaths report. Mrs. Parkinson's son brought a claim for judicial review. Can you tell us a little about the Divisional Court's decision in this case?
Well, the Divisional Court's decision is important because it was really the first opportunity the Divisional Court has had to state or restate the principles as they have been enunciated by the European Court of Human Rights in Lopez de Souza. And they did so, and they summarised the principles arising from that case, namely that mere negligence will not engage Article 2, but rather only a failure which results from, and here they use the language of the European Court, a dysfunction in the hospital's services, saying that this will be a structural issue linked to deficiencies in the regulatory framework. Note, not deficiencies on the part of any individual. And in trying to assist coroners and those coming before coroners' courts in being able to identify what is a mere negligence case and what is a system failure case, the Divisional Court identified that the crucial distinction is between a case where there is reason to believe that there may have been a breach which is a systemic failure in contrast to ordinary cases of medical negligence. Now, you might say, well, that rather begs the question, what then is a system failure case? And there they recite paragraph 195 of Lopez de Souza, which in English reads, the dysfunction at issue must be objectively and genuinely identifiable as systemic or structural in order to be attributable to the state authorities, and must not merely comprise individual instances where something must have been dysfunctional in the sense of going wrong or functioning badly. So what is really happening is they're identifying two meanings of dysfunction. the regulatory or system dysfunction, and another meaning dysfunction where things go badly wrong. And the point being that if things go badly wrong because of individual failure, that will not amount to system neglect. It is only where, through lack of resources, lack of properly arranged triaging systems or the like, that the death occurs, that one is even engaged with the potential for system failure. And even then, it is unlikely that a system failure argument will get on the ground unless that failure amounts to an effective denial of medical treatment.
You wrote about this particular case in a UK human rights blog earlier in the year. And as you noted there, applying this decision to the NHS is not so straightforward. Can you explain why?
With the NHS, knowing what is systemic or structural and what is individual, in fact, isn't so easy. A couple of cases illustrate that point. In Tacoosis, Court of Appeal thought that the local triaging system might be defective and required an investigation. Another case called Humberston, there was some recently produced evidence suggesting that there was an issue whether the resources and operational systems of the Yorkshire Ambulance Service were arguably deficient so as to engage Article 2. I think one has to stand back. The reality is there will always be shortage of resources in the NHS, absent some miracle. And the reality is that there will always be a combination of individual failure and system failure. And so separating out a case which is essentially attributable to pure system failure is very difficult indeed.
Jeremy, many thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you very much.
Listeners can find all the citations for today's podcast and links to more detailed analysis in articles published by members of chambers, including Jeremy's, on the UK Human Rights blog.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenelon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.